What are they trying to convey to each other? Archibald prompted him.
Three-dimensional geometry, Beller said. And since parts of the clock are moving, you'd also need time.
Everything that a worm could possibly say to a fly, or a fly to a bat, or a bat to a worm would be gibberish, Archibald said, leading Beller forward.
Kind of like saying blue to a blind man.
Blue to a blind man, except for descriptions of geometry and of time. That is the only language that these creatures could ever possibly share.
This makes me think of that geometry proof on the cousin's ship, Beller said. Are you saying that we are like the worms and the cousins are like the bats? That geometry is the only way we can speak to each other?
Oh no, Archibald said. That's not where I was going at all.
Where are you going then?
Beller asked. You know how multicellular life evolved?
Single-celled organisms clumping together for mutual advantage?
Yes, and in some cases, encapsulating one another.
I've heard of the concept.
That is what our brains are.
What?
Our brains are flies, bats, and worms that clumped together for mutual advantage. These parts of our brains are talking to each other all the time, translating what they perceive moment to moment into the shared language of geometry. That's what a brain is. That's what it is to be conscious. Beller spent a few seconds mastering the urge to run away screaming, then a few minutes pondering this. Archibald watched him closely the whole time.
You don't mean literally that our brains evolved that way,
Beller protested. Of course not.
That's a relief.
But I put it to you, Furman, that our brains are functionally indistinguishable from ones that evolved thus.
Because our brains have to be doing that kind of processing all the time,
just in order for us to be conscious. To integrate our sensory perceptions into a coherent model of ourselves and our surroundings.
Is this that sconic stuff you were talking about earlier?
Archibald nodded. To a first approximation, yes. It is post-sconic. Certain metatheoricians who had been strongly influenced by the sconics came up with arguments like this one later, around the time of the first harbinger, which was a bit more detail than Furman Beller really wanted to hear, but Archibald's eyes flicked in my direction as if to confirm what I'd been suspecting. He had been reading up on this kind of thing as part of his research into the work that Evan Edrick had pursued later in his life. I lingered on the edge of that dialogue until it started to wind down. Then I got up and headed straight for my bunk, planning to sleep good and hard. But Archibald, moving uncharacteristically fast, chased me out of the dining hall and ran me down.
"What's on your mind?" I asked him.
"Some of the hunters held a little calca just before dinner.
I noticed.
They couldn't get the numbers to add up."
"Which numbers?"
"That ship simply isn't big enough to travel between star systems in a reasonable amount of time. It can't possibly hold a sufficient number of atomic bombs to accelerate its own mass to relativistic velocity."
"Well," I said, "maybe it split off from a mothership that we haven't seen yet, and that is that big."
"It doesn't look like it's that kind of vessel," Archibald said. "It is huge, with space to support tens of thousands of people indefinitely."
"Too big to be a shuttle, too small for interstellar cruising," I said.
"Precisely."
"Seems like you are making a lot of assumptions, though."
"That is a fair criticism," he said with a shrug.
But I could tell he had some other hypothesis. "Okay, what do you think?" I asked him.
"I think it is from another cosmos," he said.
"And that is why they evoked Paphlagon."
We were at the door of my cabin.
"This cosmos we're living in has me flummoxed," I said. "I don't know whether I can start thinking about additional ones at this point in the day."
"Good night, then, Erasmus."
"Good night, Archibald."